I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, guys. It is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun, too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino-style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. One of the lessons I've learned while recording Preconceived is that it's so easy for anyone, including myself, to follow the status quo. In many ways, the status quo is the equivalent of the preconceived, the normal way of looking at things. What can become scary, though, is the question of, what if the status quo that I've been following is actually wrong? After all, things like slavery, human sacrifice, and all sorts of persecution had all been so normalized in certain societies at certain periods that many people simply following the status quo might not have appreciated the moral implications of what they were subscribing to at the time. Sometimes, even today, our convictions are so indoctrinated in us that it's tough to separate them from reality and the facts in front of us. One such example is the Salem witch trials from 1692 to 1693, where an episode of mass hysteria in Salem, Massachusetts, led to hundreds of people being put on trial for witchcraft and ultimately the executions of 19 of them. So how did this happen? How was it possible that people in one of the most educated societies of the time, not far from Harvard, became so convinced that witchcraft was real to the point that they killed 14 women and 5 men for being witches? I'm joined today by Marilyn Roach. Marilyn is a writer, researcher, illustrator, and lecturer, has so far written 9 books for adults and children on topics ranging from Thoreau at Walden to the Salem witch trials, and articles for publications as diverse as the Lizzie Borden Quarterly and the New England Historical and Genealogical Register. She was an associate editor on the definitive records of the Salem witch hunt and a member of the Gallows Hill Project that proved the correct location of the 1692 hangings, included in Archaeology Magazine's list of the world's 10 most important discoveries in 2017. Roach's The Salem Witch Trials, a day-by-day chronicle of a community under siege, is considered the Bible of the Salem Witch Trials. She's currently writing the companion volume, Six Men of Salem, to her biographical Six Women of Salem, The Untold Story of the Accused and the Accusers in the Salem Witch Trials. All right, Marilyn Roach, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
We're talking about the Salem Witch Trials today, which has always fascinated me, though admittedly, as I did a little bit of research for this topic beforehand, I realized I had many misconceptions as well about the topic, as I'm sure many people do. Before we get into the history of the Salem Witch Trials in particular, I want to talk a little bit about witch trials and witchcraft in general and how they were viewed before this period, because my understanding is that Salem was by no means the first place. In fact, it might have been one of the later places where witchcraft trials occurred. So what was the history? How common were witch trials between, let's say, the 15th and 18th centuries in Europe?
Well, I was surprised to learn that most of the actual trials in Europe took place in the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. It was a reaction to something. But there was a longer time period when they happened, so that the numbers are greater. It adds up to a lot more than what happened in New England and in Salem, but Salem's outbreak was one of the last in the Western world, so that it stood out like a sore thumb, and it was an anomaly in its own time.
I think people would find it surprising that in the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, periods that we look back at not fully fondly, because there's a lot of nuance, there was still a lot of war and a lot of bad things happened then, but it was a period where humanity was coming out of the Middle Ages, so to speak, which is a period where people might intuitively have thought, well, that's when it would have happened. What do you think occurred in the Renaissance and Enlightenment that caused witchcraft to be a concern for people? Or just in general, whether, because there were obviously reasons that most of us don't understand as to how somebody could believe in witchcraft.
Well, the idea that magic can happen is all over the globe, at least in some parts of somebody's history, so that it wasn't as unusual for people to think that perhaps something that didn't have a physical reason for happening could have happened, whether it was what they suspected or not.
So with the Salem witch trials, I think even without a detailed history of the European witch trials, it's just helpful to know that it wasn't a novel thing. While it was seen as something very strange and memorable and unique for all the wrong reasons in Salem, witchcraft was not unique to the colonies. Witchcraft had occurred before, and that's, I guess, the important point that I hadn't necessarily appreciated.
Yeah, and in England during the Civil Wars, there was a big outbreak in the 1640s where there was a concentration of accusations and witch finding and Matthew Hopkins doing his thing in England. And it was after that, which I hope was an anomaly in England, but that the English settlers in New England maybe got more suspicious, because at least the records of people being suspected and accused seemed to start around.
So Salem was an anomaly in some sense because a lot of the witch craze had already died down in other parts of the world.
It had, so that, like, when you're in a noisy room trying to be heard talking, and you raise your voice and shout out whatever your opinion is, and everybody else has suddenly gone quiet, so that you're the only one making noise, it stands out. And it also ended it in the colonies, certainly in New England, because it served as a lesson of what not to do. But yeah, it was a great big mess. Endlessly fascinating if you're not going to get personally accused.
The last thing before we transition to Salem, which is the main part of this conversation, whether it's in Europe or general, what were some of the traditional reasons behind this concern for witchcraft? Was it trying to explain things like plagues or medical things that could have no other explanation? Was it a way of explaining certain world phenomena that they didn't have the science to understand back then?
Well, something would go wrong and people would suspect a neighbor. But yeah, some of it would be that they didn't understand a medical reason. But at the beginning of Salem, there was a lot of consulting doctors about certain people with symptoms, and the doctors could not come up with a diagnosis. So they did try, but it was limited to what they knew, although they were aware that there were illnesses that could cause bad reactions. But still, since it was theoretically possible that a witch, a neighbor, could be casting spells that would hurt people or hurt the livestock, if there was some quarrel going on, it's usually a pre-existing quarrel, and then something bad happens coincidentally, then people might wonder if the neighbor had magically caused the cow to die or the kid to get sick or whatever.
It was in many ways a response to events happening that lacked other explanation.
Yeah, and coincidences really did not help. And of course, the Salem outbreak happened at a time when everything else was going.
So let's pivot to Salem. What was the situation in Salem before or as the witch trials began? Was there any particular scenario or cultural situation that was going on amongst the settlers in Massachusetts that made Salem perhaps a prime place where this could have and did eventually happen?
Well, the government was on an uncertain footing because England had taken the charter away that made it legal. And after years of negotiation, the crown had just allowed a new one. Nobody knew what was in it yet, but how much self-rule would there be? Because there had been a royal governor appointed for all of northeastern colonies together to rule it when things got unruly earlier. And he had just been a few years before revolted against, put under arrest, and shipped back to England. And fortunately, there was a regime change in England, which made this seem a lot less illegal. So they don't know how much self-rule they're going to have. They are also, the English colony, they're also at war with France, or the French colonies, and there are border raids between French Canada and New England and upstate New York. So the fact that that could happen, it has everybody on edge. Because of the conflict with Canada and Acadia, the two separate colonies still then, there's a privateering between the two cultures, of French Canadian privateers and New England privateers taking each other's ships. And of course, that gives all sorts of opportunities for regular pirates, and they're around too. So New England has a lot of maritime trade that they're dependent on, and the shipping is getting captured or recaptured, and people on the outlying towns are being perhaps held hostage by the French and the various Wabanaki Confederacy people. And they have to be ransomed back. It's really tense. There has been smallpox. There isn't a big outbreak at this time, but they're not sure. You're not sure until it's over if you've had a plague. So there's disease too. And it's not doing the economy any good. And then within Salem itself, the rural end of town called Salem Village, they have their own congregation there, and they have their own local committee, which is like selectmen, but they're still part of Greater Salem. That part of town is not getting along very well with each other internally, mainly over the minister that they have hired. They've had four ministers once they were able to start their own congregation out there for geographic reasons, mostly. And every time somebody suggests that they have him ordained to be their permanent minister, their congregational, so each church is responsible for doing that themselves, then there's opposition, whether they really want this person or not. And three of them have left and gone to the frontier, but one of them, because it seemed more peaceful than in town. But they've just hired Samuel Parris a couple of years before they negotiate. He's ordained. He's supposed to be, serving them for life. But then apparently the second thoughts are personality conflicts, and there's a a number of people in town who decide that this is really not the person we should have. So they're not going to pay towards his salary. It's winter. He's running out of firewood and hasn't been paid for a while, about a year. And at the same time, there is a really spectacular attack on York, Maine by French and Wabanaki forces. And York, Maine is in the southern part. It's getting closer and closer to Massachusetts, that sort of event. So people are reasonably afraid of that happening close by. It seems to be around the time that that happened at the end of January that two girls in Reverend Parris's household start acting oddly, but they have aches and pains. They're making odd sounds, something about crawling under the furniture. It could have been games, but it seems to be more serious than that. And I really don't know what was causing it, because the family treats it like an illness at first, home remedies and so forth. Of course, they're praying for it, which they do anyway. And then they call in the local doctor and some area doctors that sort of ride circuit around the towns to see who needs a doctor. And they can't come up with a reason at all either, until one of them says perhaps they're under an evil hand, meaning a curse, a witch's spell. And they don't do anything about that straight away. But I'm sure the girls hear that, and the neighbors know it, and the word spreads, because gossip was a favorite indoor sport then as now. But, you know, if that's happening, that's yet another threat against everything. So when the parents, when Mr. and Mrs. Parris are away for the day, a neighbor suggests to the two enslaved people in the household an English folklore, not a remedy exactly, but a way of finding out who the guilty witch is. And then they'll reveal themselves and they'll know who to deal with. So it involves making a witch cake charm. You take cheap flour, you don't want to waste it, mix it with the victim's urine, because it can be safely detached from their body. It has some of them in it. And presumably the person who has sent the evil magic, some of them goes into the hurt in the person. So if you bake it in the ashes, feed it to the dog, and there are some dogs who will eat anything. I assume the process of chewing it up and so on is what hurts the witch, and then they'll come around trying to see what's hurting them. Well, that doesn't happen. I assume the dog did what it was asked to do, but nobody comes around exactly. But the two girls now that they are aware that the adults think it really is a witch hurting them, they start seeing apparitions and reporting names. Now, I'm sure the people have been, even if they didn't mean to suggest names, they've been whispering possible suspects. And I've heard that if somebody is panicking and breathing shallowly, it can not get enough oxygen to your brain, for one thing, and eyes, so that your peripheral vision closes in a bit. And I wonder myself if that makes it look as if there's some shadowy something sneaking up on you. And at this point, I imagine they're very suggestive. Of course, the other theory is that it lies from beginning to end, but Puritan parents didn't take a lot of nonsense from children, their children, even if they weren't focused, as the stereotypes put it. But it was convincing enough to them, and now they name three people.
So the children here who are sick, they eventually, they're mentioning some names because the idea of witchcraft has been floated around. Perhaps that resonates with them of maybe we are sick because of that. Then who knows why? Maybe it was fabricated, or maybe there were hallucinations. Maybe there were visual things that they were seeing. They were also not well, so it's possible that that was affecting them. And then they start kind of emphasizing this idea, well, actually, there are some witches around here. Now, would that have been very atypical at the time? Because listening to this, a lot of people are probably saying, well, I mean, sickness was very common back then, right? So how do you, especially if witchcraft was no longer common in Europe and it was kind of not something that was common in Salem at this time to be such a heavy concern, how does that idea get floated to such an extent that people start believing it and that the authorities start looking into this and trials start to begin?
Right. Well, two other girls who live in opposite ends of the village, one to the east, one to the west, are also showing similar symptoms. And one of them was the niece of the doctor, of a doctor, who is probably the one who said they're under an evil hand. Well, it was a possibility, and at first they had a meeting, and some neighboring ministers came and observed how the girls were. But they wait for a couple of weeks before anybody goes to the magistrates about this, and it was three or four farmers in the neighborhood. One of them, the father of one of the other girls, who was also showing symptoms. And they made a complaint against the three suspects, and arrest warrants were issued to have a hearing about to ask them to speak for themselves. One of them was the enslaved woman, Tituba, in the minister's household. The other was Sarah Good, a woman who had to beg back for her children's sake, because her husband just wasn't very good at supporting the family, and which is putting it mildly.
Like he was throwing them under the bus a little bit for witchcraft.
He did not support her when she came.
Yeah.
And Sarah Osborne, who had been widowed and then married the bond servant who took over the farm, and the sons didn't get it, and it was a big mess there. She's arrested too. So on March 1st, when this starts in 1692, there's a hearing which is supposed to convene in the local in Salem village. A couple of magistrates come up from town, which is down by the harbor. But so many people in the neighborhood want to know what's going on that they adjourn to the larger meeting house down the road. So the court adjourns there because so many people show up. And they question the three suspects one at a time. And they all say that they didn't do it. Sarah Good said she didn't do it. She's not too sure about the other two, but she certainly didn't do it. Sarah Osborne said she did not do it, that she's been ill, but she certainly is not somebody who has pledged themselves to the devil, which is what a witch was assumed to be, a regular human who deliberately joins the side of evil and wants to make everything worse for all the other people around in revenge for what.
So that's an important point. So it's believed that a witch is somebody who intentionally decides to be a witch. It's not somebody who is born as a witch. Is that accurate?
Yes, it's a choice. It's not a magical person, and it's not the same as modern neo-pagan Wiccans. It's not like
this is not born as Harry. This is not like you. Harry Potter was born a wizard, and Hermione was born
a
witch.
All benign too. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
No. It's and then there's of course the question as to how much is a supposed witch supposed to be able to do on their own, or is it the devil's illusion? But so the first two say they didn't do it, and the third one, Tituba, she keeps saying she's innocent. She says the questions are relentless. And of course, since her status is slave, it's not a lot of support for her, not there was for the other two. But she has only her wits to save her.
My understanding is that Tituba actually, and perhaps not as wisely as she thought, because by acknowledging that she knew witchcraft is somewhat implicating her, she actually says a lot of really damning things in her confessions that propel this much further, that she's saying, yes, I have seen witchcraft. She names some other people, and that gets this going even more. Is that correct?
Yes, she finally she has to give them the answers they are expecting because they're certainly not shutting up. But she says she's a victim of witches, that she's seen the devil in the parsonage, she's seen the other two suspects, and that they're making her go along with them to hurt the girls, invisibly, of course, but the girls can see them there. So she's saying that she's being forced to go with them like a hostage, but it's accepted that she's collaborating with them, had collaborated with them. But she's naming names, the two suspects that have already been questioned. But she says that there were other people and that they invisibly went to us. So people came up from Boston invisibly who were witches. And she doesn't know who they were and she doesn't know the local ones, but there's at least nine other people. Who are the other nine people? Everybody needs to know. But she can't talk anymore. She says, they won't let me see. I'm blind enough. And they finally stop asking questions. But now she's described a conspiracy of witches, not just the three suspects that everybody thought they knew about. So there's more. And people are wondering, well, who else is out there among us, like the terrorists undercover, ready to do something awful and could be a neighbor? And they think about it for a while, and finally other accusations come.
Once this gets going, mm-hmm. how many people end up going on trial, and how does this manifest in the city? Is there? It's been described as true hysteria, that anybody was fair game, and there was just this mass fear and panic, because even as you said, a father and husband wasn't even willing to help clear the names of his family. So how far did this go? How many people were accused, put on trial, and ultimately sentenced?
Yeah, well, I approximated about 191 people who were at least named at one point, but not necessarily arrested. And about 164, there's some sort of legal action about them, but again, some cases, there's not much paperwork left. But we know that there were 52 trials, that is, the grand. Most of those took place after the panic had subsided, fortunately, because it was due process. I mean, we just heard about the hearing for the first three, but then the magistrates would decide whether the people should be held for future trial. And because this is a capital offense, witchcraft, they wanted to hold off on having any trials yet, because the charter is going to arrive, and then they'll know how much local authority they'll have. So they put that off, and the jails fill up like crazy. But in the course of the summer, once they start the actual trials, 27 people in the course of the summer found guilty, and 19 of them are hanged a few at a time in the 4 months before finally it has gotten so out of hand that people are changing their mind about what's probably happening, especially if you've got relatives that you actually like who are being accused. So in October, that was the quiet month when people started to rethink things, and they didn't stop believing that witchcraft was possible, but they could see that the way the court was proceeding, it was just making everything worse, because people were more worked up. So that they put a stop to the trial until England could give them advice. And although the jails are still full of people, so they begin some trials again the next January. This time, and this is a key thing I should have said before, this time the court is not supposed to use spectral evidence, which is reports of what the bewitched. And in the course of the year, it starts with four girls, but there were at least 70 people who were considered bewitched at one time or another. And some of them are testifying in court and having convulsions in court where everyone can see, which seemed to be very impressive, because that's what the magistrates were believing. We can see something is happening in front of our eyes. But spectral evidence is what they see in their vision, the apparition they're reporting, but nobody else can see this. So the question is, are they really seeing it? Which is theoretically possible by their philosophy, but it could be the devil's delusion, also illness, which they knew could cause people to see things. And if it's the devil's delusion, then the devil is making us all tear each other's lives apart. So let's not continue with that. So in January, they weren't supposed to accept factual evidence, and most of the cases get dismissed by the grand jury. A number of them go to trial, and of the January trials in Salem for Essex County, three people were found guilty, and the king's attorney gave it as his opinion that the evidence against them was no better than the evidence against the people who had already died the summer before. So they're reprieved at the last minute. It's subsequent trials for Suffolk and Middlesex and Essex County again that went through May, nobody's found guilty. Most of the cases missed, or they're just found not guilty in that sort of it, except for a whole lot of bad feelings and shattered lives. But it was spectral evidence they should not have been paying attention to at all, for the reasons that they came to the reasoning afterwards, or most people did, that they had just been deluded as to what was right or wrong, and you cannot trust spectral evidence. It should never be used. And after that, if somebody suspected somebody of witchcraft, and suspicion lasted here and there, the courts would not touch it, period.
It sounds like a lot of factors came into play. Obviously, one is they were still waiting for some direction from England, which is what led to the initial trials then being discordant with the trials that happened the following January. One misconception is that witches were burnt at the stake. And I think that's surprising when I was looking at this, that these witches actually, or I'm calling them witches, these people were not burned at the alleged witches, yes, they were not burned at the stake. They were hanged, which it sounds weird to call humane, but it is more humane than burning at the stake. Was burning at the stake something that was much more common in Europe when we think of that?
It was in Europe on the continent, and I think in Scotland a few times, maybe, because it was a different set of laws. But no, witchcraft was a felony in England. And an English colony, and felons were hanged.
When we look at the legal process and the way things happened in the courts, all these trials, one thing that strikes me is, when looking back at this, do people look and say, wow, there were fundamental errors in how they went about these court proceedings? Were they biased? Were they on a proverbial witch hunt? Or were they doing their best, these people, and they didn't really have an agenda? And the reason I say that is because one of the striking things about this whole story is that Salem, Massachusetts, and Massachusetts in general, and correct me if I'm wrong, was considered one of the most educated places in the world at this point, which makes it extremely, extremely hard to believe that this all happened. I mean, Harvard is very close to there. Many of the people in the community had been to Harvard or had connections with Harvard, which, as we know, is one of the most esteemed universities at that time and today. So how could this have happened? How could the lawyers, how could people have believed this, but how could it have then permeated into the judicial system that they were able to prosecute so many people successfully?
Well, most of the judges on the particular court for the witches, I guess, were Harvard men. Well, it was not considered impossible then that this could happen. Certainly some of the questions and answers that have been preserved in the hearings, it does sound like the local magistrate, John Hawthorne, was convinced at the beginning that they were guilty. But his first question is not, are you a witch? Why are you doing this to the children? The reaction.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites.
So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Because there were convulsions involved in the bewitched people. So there's a lot of commotion going on, but you sort of know something's going on in the notes, but you don't get the audio part of it. You could maybe read the questions and answers and a few comments from the crowd. Apparently any courtroom in England or colonies was a lot more audience participation than is allowed now in a courtroom. But it must have been really alarming because they were ordinarily sensible, even if they were stern. Those were, but what the judges said afterwards and the supporters was that they did the best with what they had, what seemed to be going on, and they intended well, but they had to have been a lot less neutral in their thoughts than they thought they were, because it just went so bad so quickly.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Is this an example where it's just people jumping on the bandwagon, so to speak? Because a couple people mentioned witches at the beginning. There's this emotional connection that these two children are unwell. The word witch gets thrown out. People are searching for explanations because emotionally they care. The idea of witchcraft has existed in Europe, albeit not common at this point in the colonies. And then a couple more people mention it. And it just turns into this thing that nobody could have anticipated.
Unanticipated, yeah, because it got so big. That's what was strange. I imagine a lot of old hard feelings turned up. And then there'd be self-fulfilling prophecies of not feeling well. And then after a while, people did confess. Some people were so confused and frightened when they were being questioned in court that they confessed. There was one girl, a teenager, who had been in Maine, and it sounded like she sort of played around with the idea of being a witch, and then it got taken seriously. But I don't think she was serious about it, but then people took it that way. But mostly when some of the women who did confess afterwards made a statement that even their near relatives were saying, well, we know you're a witch, so why don't you admit it? But the women who had confessed, some of them said that they didn't know what they had said, that maybe they had agreed with something the magistrate asked, but they were shocked afterwards to find out that it was considered that whatever they said was an admission of guilt, and that they were allied with the devil, and that they were trying to hurt their neighbors, and so forth, and that that's not what they were at all. Yeah, so they tried to take it back. But every time someone did confess out of fear or in the hope of delaying the process, then it seemed to prove that, yeah, there really is a conspiracy out there, because they just sent state's evidence.
Yeah, the prosecutors and the judges, they were kind of hearing what they wanted to hear, even though a lot of these confessions were, whether you want to call them forced or fear-based.
Fear-based, yes.
So this obviously is a very, very infamous incident in American history. On the one hand, it's a silly question because it's just such a crazy story. On the other hand, though, if this had happened in Europe before, why is this considered kind of such a unique event that people are so fascinated with when it had been seen many times before in Europe and other parts of the world? Was it because it was so abnormal in the colonies?
I'm not sure. As I said, it stuck out like a sore thumb. But there's a lot of records that survive. And because it was later in the history of things, the records have survived well. And not all of them. There's a lot of details I'd like to know. And then it becomes part of history and literature. Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible, certainly is known worldwide, when even in countries which had really big witch persecution outbreaks, but it's failing. And fiction is easier to read than a lot of technical documents.
I mean, for me and for you, I imagine it's closer to home because it physically is closer to home. You're in the States and I'm in Canada, so the idea of it. But then when you kind of look at the bigger picture, I guess that's why I ask, because it's a crazy story anytime people are accused of witchcraft,
right,
burned at the stake or hanged, but especially this. What happened to those two young girls? Did they ever recover their health?
Yeah, it was a daughter and a niece. The niece kind of disappears from the court record, and then we really don't know what happened to her. The daughter recovered because she was sent away from the turmoil for a while, and apparently that calmed down. But she grows up and gets married and has kids, leads a normal life. And they didn't testify in court that much. It took up a life of its own. And others in the neighborhood and in other towns too testified longer or at different stages of the panic, depending on who's being accused, because it spread to other towns. It wasn't just Salem Village.
Marilyn, what is the lesson or multiple lessons that you take out of this? I thought this was a relevant topic for Preconceived because, in the vein of Preconceived, we often view what we're doing to be right at the time. And Preconceived is, in many ways to me, synonymous with the status quo. But then what happens when our preconceptions are wrong? Or we look back and the status quo was wrong, but we were all following it. And sometimes the intention isn't even bad. They may not have been bad people. I don't think there's such thing as necessarily binary good or bad, but for ease of speech, they might not have been bad people. They might have genuinely been believing that what they were doing was for the greater good, but in the name of that, they did bad things. And Preconceived is about challenging how we can get to a place where sometimes we are doing things that are not good, but because they're so ingrained in us, we continue to follow them. To me, that's what sparked my interest in the topic. But I'm curious, maybe a lesson or two that you take out of this, given all your extensive research in the area.
Well, for one thing, someone is accused of a crime. It's not necessary to think that the crime is impossible for that person to be innocent. The question is, what you think is happening, is it actually happening or is it some other cause? And is that person, the suspect, really doing anything? We think evil magic is impossible, therefore no one can be guilty of it. But there are other crimes, like, say, terrorism. It happens and people do it, but is, say, a suspect, has that person had anything to do with what you think is going on? And examine the evidence, don't jump to conclusions. If we think that a crime has to be impossible for someone to be innocent of it, like the witchcraft trials, then we can't really draw any lessons with crimes that we think are possible, which are possible. so that you really have to be careful about evidence, accepting evidence as pointing to a specific person being guilty of a specific crime. What did they actually do or not do?
So if I'm hearing you correctly, are you saying that looking at witchcraft as something that is impossible isn't necessarily the best approach for this?
Right, because then you don't learn anything if you think it's impossible, which we hope evil magic is impossible. But because then whatever we think about an alleged criminal, we just assume we know what we're doing when we come to that point.
Fascinating. So if we look at something that sounds ridiculous and we just label it as ridiculous, it's easier to maybe even charge somebody with it and not apply proper due process to it, because we're in a different realm. We're no longer dealing with reality, so we're no longer dealing with our real laws and our real ways of looking at evidence. Whereas if you take it seriously and you don't say that is completely supernatural, that is something that couldn't happen, if you look at it that way, then you're more likely to act in ways that you otherwise wouldn't have acted when assessing a regular crime.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Because people tend to dismiss Salem's problem as, you know, something stupid that they would never do. We wouldn't do that. We wouldn't fall for that. We're so smart, we can't make mistakes. And anyway, there are witch accusations nowadays in other parts of the world. So I think that in 92, people believed that it's possible and that they were doing their best and they were not all ill-intentioned.
That is the perfect line you said, that it's so easy for people to say today, we're so smart, we wouldn't make mistakes. But that's exactly the crux of this for me, again, that I find so fascinating, because it scares me sometimes when I'm doing these topics or when I'm thinking about different things in the world, because most of us think, yeah, we're smart enough, we wouldn't make these mistakes. But then all you have to do is look back in history and see, wow, these things happened. So keeping that in the back of our minds as we live in this world, as we assess the decisions we make, as we follow the status quos we're following, it's good to keep that in mind that, you know what, we're not so smart. We could be making mistakes. And one of the ways to deal with that is exactly how you suggested, by looking at any problem, as ludicrous as it might sound, and thinking about it critically and applying proper judicial framework to it and not just dismissing it, which might be counterintuitive to what some people would think, where they'd say, oh, witchcraft, throw it out, and you put it in this whole separate bucket where you don't give it the attention that it deserves. Marilyn, do you have any final thoughts or greatest misconceptions about Salem that you want to end on?
Well, they weren't all a bunch of idiots, but, well, they did admit that it, generally speaking, they did admit that it had gone wrong. There was a public fast in 1697, which is the church. You go to your own church and there's a service and an apology before the community and God that things have been going badly because you made mistakes. There were a number of reasons why people were apologizing. In there was, in fact, the witch trials, which is still a sore subject. And so a few made personal apologies rather than this, I showed up for the service, so, you know, I'm part of the group of apologies. And then there were, from 1701 until 2022, we've almost come up on the anniversary of the clearing of the last person who had been found guilty of witchcraft, but their names were cleared. So it's in the books that they were not really witches, even though there was a verdict. And that last one happened a year ago, July.
Wow. Well, Marilyn Roach, thank you so, so much for joining me. It's been a really enlightening conversation, one of my favorite types of topics to explore, and a really, really interesting and well-articulated lesson that you summarized at the end there. People can check out your books, The Salem Witch Trials, A Day-by-Day Chronicle of a Community Under Siege, as well as the biographical Six Women of Salem, The Untold Story of the Accused and Their Accusers in the Salem Witch Trials. And then you also have a new book coming out as well, correct? Six Men of Salem?
I'm working on that, and I'll get to that later this afternoon.
Well, thank you for taking the time away from that. I will put your website in the episode notes, which has links to those books. And thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. Have a great day.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com